Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast, coming from Dallas, Texas, Los Angeles, and Sacramento, California. Here's Skylar Teo, Aaron Alvarado, and David Stauffer.
Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. I'm here in Utah for work, but joining me, as usual, from Los Angeles, California, is Aaron Alvarado. What's up, Aaron?
Hiya, David. How you doing?
Hey, why isn't Skylar joining us today?
Well, he has a physical aversion to apes.
Yeah, well, yes. I believe the words were when we asked him to watch it, right, and to do this pod, he says, "I don't watch movies with those damn dirty apes." And he said it in a Charlton Heston voice, just like the original. Have you seen the original Planet of the Apes, like the series?
I've seen it on TV in bits and pieces. I never sat down and watched the entire thing. But also, I didn't even watch the Tim Burton ones. Is there only one?
It's just one. Yeah. Mark Wahlberg, Paul Giamatti. What's great about the Tim Burton one, though, is that there is a Charlton Heston cameo where he repeats the line, "Damn dirty apes." It's pretty great. Yeah. And he's got a rifle in his cold, dead fingers.
With all the CGI used in the War for Planet of the Apes, I'm surprised they didn't try to bring back Charlton Heston.
Well, you know, I have a theory about this. I have a theory that Woody Harrelson was not in this movie. That was CGI Woody the whole time. So there's a lot of places we could start here. But I'm going to ask you a question, speaking of that CGI, now that you mention it.
Yeah.
Is this the greatest CGI you've ever seen in a film?
Man, you know, I've been pondering this. I've really been thinking about this long and hard. And thinking back to the movie itself, and there are some moments when I thought these were physical creatures in front of the movie camera.
Yes.
It is unreal how lifelike, like especially the scenes that I'm thinking of are when the fur gets wet.
Yeah.
It's incredible how lifelike it is. Now there's still a little bit of that uncanny valley with the facial features and stuff like that. But overall, I think this is the best. This is the cutting edge of CGI work.
I'm totally with you. This is the best CGI work I've seen, period. And it's done by Weta Digital in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. The folks, you know, did Lord of the Rings and whatnot. I actually have a friend that lives in New Zealand, not the one that we had come on the pod, a different one that's actually from Sacramento originally, but he moved out to New Zealand to work for Weta. He worked on The Jungle Book and he worked on this movie. I don't know the extent that he worked on this film, but he's been posting about it a lot on Facebook, and I want to get him on the pod. Well, I want to reach out to him and ask him, like, you know, how much he worked on this film. I know he did.
Yeah.
And if he did a lot, I think it'd be great to do another episode and bring him on and talk about it, because it is so shocking how good this CGI is. Yeah. There's a scene in particular for me where this ape puts his head through this hole in the ground and he sticks his head out. And I'm looking at it thinking, that's a physical, it's a mask or it's an actual ape. Like, I can't believe this is CGI. I really can't. It's incredible work.
Yeah, and I most of the time, to be quite honest, I hate CGI movies, especially with any sort of talking creature or something. It pulls me right out. And this movie, from the very beginning, I was sucked in and I was a believer. And I think that's a credit to all the artists that worked on it, and as well as the actors as well, because, you know, they lend their, not just their voice, but they lend also their movements. Like, it's
their facial expressions. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I want to get into that a little bit later on about you know, whether it's time to really consider these performances, you know, from the Academy Awards sense, right? Like, for me, it's Andy Serkis should absolutely be considered, should get a nomination for Best Actor here. Now, there's a lot of stuff on the CGI front. And what's interesting is I think all of the Apes films, this being the final, you know, of the trilogy, all of them have been pretty cutting edge and pretty incredible. But they just keep getting better, and this one is just the pinnacle of not CGI within the trilogy, but CGI in film. It's really incredible stuff. But CGI aside, this story, I thought, for me, was unexpected. It actually wasn't the type of movie I thought I was going to see from a story standpoint. Part of that has to do with the promotional materials and the word war in the title. But I thought personally that this film was incredible, and such a perfect ending for these three films. It's unique. While it's certainly more like the second film than it is the first film, right? In the first film, they're all very unique, and they stand alone apart from each other, but they tell the story that combined with the CGI makes for such a unique cinematic experience.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I really enjoyed the first two Ape movies, and I was actually looking forward to this one. The trailer, first of all, it sold me. The trailer looked great. Oh, it was one of the better trailers I've seen in a while. And I got to say, for a summer blockbuster movie, this is an amazing film. It basically doesn't get any better as far as popcorn viewing goes for me personally. I felt like the story had a ton of layers. The characters were all distinctly different with different motivations and great performances. And, you know, for me, I think it's one of the better movies that I've seen this year, probably in the top five.
Yeah, it's interesting because talking about the Planet of the Apes, like the original, I can't say that I'm super, super familiar with the series. I have seen all of them. My dad was a big fan of them, and I watched them when I remember as a kid growing up, at least once all the way through, and some of them more than once. But like I, you know, it's not like I rewatched them a ton. It certainly is not the type of thing that I think of as like, oh yeah, I want a remake of Planet of the Apes, right? Like that needs a remake. Like we talk all the time about remake culture, and it's way too much of it happening. But this is what's crazy is when they first announced Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I couldn't have been less excited. It's like, why do we need a Planet of the Apes? Like, I don't understand why we need this. And then that first James Franco one was like, oh, this is totally different.
Yeah.
Like, this is a really good example of taking source material and putting a new spin on it, where a remake was totally justified. It's a completely different story, and it's executed at such a high level that it's like, oh, man. Yeah, there are going to be cases like this where I don't think I need it, but I totally needed this.
Yeah, that first, The Rise?
Yeah.
The Rise of the Planet of the Apes. You know, I have a soft spot for any sort of monkey movie. I'm really interested in that aspect of it. So,
like Dunstan Checks In.
Oh, loved it.
with Jason Alexander. Yeah, I hope someone listening understands that reference, because I know Aaron probably doesn't.
Oh, I've seen Dunstan Checks
In.
Oh,
you have seen me?
Yes, the orangutan.
Yeah, okay.
The orangutan.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so, I saw the first, The Rise, and I went in with very low expectations, and even though I like James Franco, I thought the movie was great. I thought it was really inventive, and again, had the cutting-edge CGI. You had some really interesting characters, and I thought Dawn was a great second step. I thought it took all the things that worked from the first one and made them bigger and a lot darker. I thought it definitely took a darker turn. I appreciated that, considering the world that they built.
With Dawn, consider how ballsy it is to do a sequel without your lead actors, without the same cast other than the ape, Caesar,
exactly.
I guess, like Maurice and some of the other ones. But like, you have a leading man in James Franco,
right?
And John Lithgow, even. I mean, completely clear the deck and then bring in Jason Clarke and others. I mean,
it's a bold move, and I thought it totally worked because of how the strength of the world that they built. And then we see even more of the world in The War for the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah,
and again, it's my favorite film of the franchise, I would say, of the three. It's definitely the darkest with the most bleak setting. But it needed it, I think, for the world that they built and the characters in it. Just all around entertaining, and I'm really glad that they put money into this thing. And I would say the job that Matt Reeves did as the director, he has me psyched for his next project, which apparently is Batman. So
yes, and that's right. And you, unlike Skyler and myself, you have hopes.
High hopes, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, I think Ben Affleck, he's a great Batman. Say what you will about...
No, he is. No, look, the guy was born to play a superhero.
Yes.
And I do think that, like, even though, like, we just got the best Batman we're going to get with Christian Bale stuff, like, it feels weird running it back. And granted, we just talked about Spider-Man being good, and that's the third one of those. But, like, Ben Affleck, when he did Daredevil, I always thought it was a shame because I was like, dude, the guy looks like a superhero and he could really do it. It's just a shame that movie was bad, right?
Well, okay, that's a good thing that you brought up the Spider-Man, because I feel like I am fatigued on that character, because I honestly, just thinking more about him and reading his stories, he isn't that deep. Whereas Batman is complicated. He's a really deep character with many angles, and I think that that lends itself to many different directors and writers, and I think that's why he works on a multi-tier level, whereas Spider-Man is just kind of like, he's just Spider-Man.
Yeah. Well,
so that's why one of the reasons why I'm excited to see what Matt Reeves does.
I have a I would be so shocked if he went from directing something like War for the Planet of the Apes, which is so expertly crafted, to go and do a Batman that totally sucks. Right.
Yeah, I don't think it's possible. They already said they're scrapping the script, so they're starting from scratch.
Yeah, but then that gives you a disgruntled Batman. Maybe that's what you want. You want Ben Affleck to be angry. I think it's impossible. I will say this: Matt Reeves is the anti Zack Snyder, and that's going to be very helpful. And he's so different from Christopher Nolan that we're not going to have to worry about like retreading, you know, that type of tonal Batman.
Right, and I love some of the tone choices they made in the Planet, the Apes movies. It's interesting to me, like this, the movie. One of the premises that it's a global worldwide virus that's spreading the entire globe, affecting everyone in the population. But the movies themselves focus on just this small little area, basically just north of San Francisco.
Yeah, and then into the Sierra Nevadas.
Yes, exactly. So it's hyper focused on this little group of apes, and the people that affect that are the people in that general area too. So, which is an interesting angle that I thought they took.
Yeah. So let's dive into that. Let's go into spoilers. And before we do so, I guess just sum up our thoughts and feelings that both you and I really enjoyed this film, and we highly recommend people going to see it. Go see it in the theater.
Oh yeah, for sure. There's a lot of big, loud moments that I think need to be experienced on the big screen. I'm usually always a proponent of that, but I think for a summer blockbuster movie like this, you're going to get the most out of it if you watch it in a movie theater.
Yeah. So going into spoilers, which, you know, I guess, I don't know, maybe there are some spoilers in here that are a big deal. I don't know.
I mean, there's one big one.
Yeah, there's one big one.
But it's like the logical conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's one that everyone expected. And that's Woody Harrelson, too. Mm-hmm.
When he loses his ability to speak.
Okay. I was going to say... He lost. Never mind. I'm not going to go that direction. When Woody Harrelson explains the symptoms, the virus turning humans into kind of primal or this primate state.
Yeah.
Immediately when he's saying that, I was like, oh, so your destiny is definitely that, whatever that is. I'm glad they clarified that. I was pretty confused at first when they found the girl that was a mute. And then the dude that was shot, and he's like, oh, it's a mute just like her. I was like, wait a second. Two mutes in a day? That's pretty rare. That's pretty rare.
That's also along that lines when we're introduced to the very first character that has a crossbow instead of a rifle.
Oh, yeah.
And he spared, his life is spared. You just absolutely knew that he was going to play into the final scene, the final act of the movie, based solely on the Saving Private Ryan principle, where so some of these things were telegraphed, but the movie is so good that it doesn't even matter.
It's really, really interesting because it gets moving right away, and that's you know, you have the benefit of that. They don't have to do a ton of world building; it's already built, but it gets right into the action. Like right into a big event that has major ramifications for the rest of the film, you know, and that's getting attacked and being, you know, by this crazy colonel's group. And then one of the spoilers being that Caesar's son and wife are killed.
Mm-hmm.
And he becomes so consumed with vengeance that he becomes like Koba, you know, which was kind of a sad thing to see because he was the anti-Koba, which was like what made him such a good leader.
Right.
But honestly, my favorite ape character in this is easily Maurice.
Do we know what kind of ape Maurice is, by the way? He's just a big orange thing with a whole lot of cheek.
He's got the plate face. He looks like orangutan.
Yeah, ish, right?
Yeah, but it's a type of ape. I don't know my ape stuff, but he looks completely different than the rest of them.
Yeah, he does. There's so many great scenes in this movie. Bringing up the very first intro, we get the cold open where they're you're seeing the perspective from this little battalion that's going out to hunt the apes. Mm-hmm. And right off the bat, I thought that we were going to get that perspective. I thought that we were going to get the perspective of the people that were fighting these apes to kill them off. I thought maybe like that's the story they're going to tell in this one. And I was kind of worried. I'm like, what? Are they really going to ditch Caesar? But no, they didn't.
No, they didn't. It started with him, and then it went right to, went to the apes, and it stayed with the apes.
Yeah, yeah.
And Woody Harrelson, this was just the right amount of Woody in this movie.
Yes, yeah.
And I feel like he could have shot all of his scenes in 2 days.
He probably did.
Because like, probably did. I mean, he really could have.
Right, and they have him, for anyone that doesn't know, he's playing like the Colonel Kurtz, Apocalypse Now. Character and that's actually referenced in the movie.
Totally is referenced. I love that. I loved that.
Yeah, and he played a great character. He plays a psycho really well.
So. Yeah, yeah. And when he's explaining how he had to kill his own child and like why, you know, he's trying to protect humanity, that this thing that's spreading, and I didn't get all the way there, but I was almost a little bit like, I kind of get what you're saying. Like, I kind of understand your motives, even though I totally don't agree at all with like what he's doing and how he's doing it. You know, I was glad to see a motive articulated that made him seem like, okay, I could see how a human being would get there, like mentally, right. And I could see how people would follow him.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the hardest part of this movie, right? To make us sympathetic to the apes because we're humans.
Yeah.
So, and I think they did a really great job, and I credit the CG with creating these lifelike humanoids.
Yeah.
To make us sympathetic to, because if they do it incorrectly, then we're never going to have feelings for them. I'm thinking of like,
and I was referring to the Colonel, to be clear.
Yes.
When I was saying like his reason, like what he was doing.
I agree completely.
It is funny. It is human nature that we kind of, I mean, they make it very clearly. You're supposed to be Team Ape here. Right. Yes. But, like, there is this intrinsic human thing. You're like, well, if I were around with a bunch of talking apes that could take me over, I could see why we would want to, like, do something about that.
Exactly, especially if we know that they're diseased and they're spreading virus that's killing or de-evolving humans.
Yeah.
Which was, I thought that was an interesting angle, too. I don't know if they, I don't remember them mentioning that in the first two.
Yeah.
But that was an interesting play that they had on it.
No, I know. I don't remember them mentioning that. I did want to mention about expectations with films. I alluded to earlier the title of the film being War for the Planet of the Apes, but I wouldn't really describe this as a war film per se.
No, not traditionally.
Right? Mm-hmm. But check out this, like, I come out of the theater and I see this huge cardboard, you know, War for the Planet of the Apes standee, as we call them in the theater. Create these things. I'm going to hold this up to the camera so you can see what I'm talking about, Aaron, and we'll describe it. And for those watching the video feed, you'll understand. But I'm seeing this image here of Caesar on a horse walking through a gate that is wall with tons of apes all hanging there. And he's slowly riding on a horse with two other apes on horses towards a group of, you know, army men with guns. And this scene is absolutely nowhere to be found in the film. Nothing like that ever happens. And it certainly makes it look like, oh, it's a war now, right? Get all the apes, get all the humans. It's mono, you know, just we're going to. And that's not what happens. This becomes a movie about, like, certainly revenge and sacrifice, but then imprisonment and this escape film.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, there were so many other themes going on that, you know, I talked to some coworkers of mine. You know, you and I both are big fans of this. A couple of coworkers of mine who actually liked the first two didn't like this movie. One of them said specifically, and his reasons are not great, were like, where were the tanks and the war? And like, you know, you call the movie War for the Planet of the Apes. You have posters where they're all like going at each other and then there's no war at all. You know, he's like, it's just basically it's like Moses leading, you know, leading his people out of, you know, out of Egypt, you know, out of bondage. And it's like, okay, I get the Moses parallels. Like, I understand that. But
yeah,
like,
I can understand that critique if we're going to base it solely on the way that the movie's marketed, because again, talking about that trailer, it looks like this movie is a full on battle.
It does.
From start to finish.
And there's no full on battle.
No, there isn't. Well, not between the apes and the humans, at least.
Yeah, not between the apes and the humans. And the human, we're talking spoilers, so the human human battle didn't last very long.
No, that was a great scene, though. I do like how that all culminated.
Oh, yeah, it didn't even matter. Isn't that incredible that an avalanche doesn't even matter? And it took out every single person. Where are the helicopters that were... I mean,
they were all shot down. All the helicopters.
They were all shot down. They all had just landed right before the avalanche.
Exactly. Well, they were celebrating.
Yeah. I was great to see the donkey get some, like, right at the last second, some reconciliation by helping Caesar.
So donkey, was that like that's a Donkey Kong reference, right?
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Because some of them, if you notice, said DK and some said DK Jr. on the back.
I saw him jumping in and out of barrels, doing rolls. There's a crocodile he jumped on.
I'm assuming it has something to do. I mean, I'm not aware of any other reason.
Well, they called them Kongs. Like that in the very first opening scene, they called them Kongs.
Yeah.
And I thought that was like evoking, you know, the Viet Cong, like Vietnam. And then later on, they have them like refer to them as donkey. So
unless there's some sort of epitaph, you know, for like thing that I'm not realizing or have heard of in terms of like why you'd call an ape a donkey. I'm thinking like it's got to be related to Donkey Kong. And doesn't that make kind of sense? Like, isn't that the thing people would relate it to in that era?
Probably, but also they're doing the work of a donkey.
Right,
like a
mule, and I get that. Right.
That's literal, but I think it is.
Yeah, you can't like escape the fact that Donkey Kong is...
Yeah, yeah, it's just a derogatory nickname for him, which is good. So you should call him that.
My other coworker, he loved Don, and Don is still his favorite of them. And he felt like this, in his opinion, that the story was a little hollow. And that it was just kind of like it was just about a revenge filled Caesar going out. And he just said like, and then it became, he didn't like how then it became the prison escape film. That was like a really unlikely and kind of bizarre way of actually getting them out. Mm-hmm. And it was all for naught. It was just like, I think he wanted something a little more meaningful because he said he still enjoyed it overall, but it just felt like a much more hollow, less meaningful film than Don.
I can see that. I've also heard that's a similar critique to that. But I think that if we look at it as a kind of a retelling of, like, so basically this movie has a ton of themes that it's dealing with, like imperialism and American colonialism, genocide, slavery, like all these things are tackled or mentioned at some point, basically. And I think it's pretty clear that this group of apes they're Native Americans. And so at one point Caesar is like, he's basically the chief of the tribe and he's trying to get his entire tribe from one location to another. And, these American soldiers are not going to let that happen. So like it's basically directly from our American past, where the American soldiers, essentially performed genocide on the Native American Indians. This is a similar story. This is basically the similar type of story.
And let me make an analogy that you may laugh at, but I'm telling you, this is something that people that I'm familiar with are certainly equating it to. Mm-hmm. And this is the Mormon pioneers that were looking for their Zion. I know it's funny, but like the fact like these Mormon pioneers that started in upstate New York and went to Ohio and then Missouri and Illinois and then eventually to Utah. This ending scene where Caesar comes across and sees this lake. I was just the famous line they say from Brigham Young is, "This is the place." And the friend I was seeing it with like leans over and says, "This is the place." But the idea, Missouri, and not to play like victim or anything like that, there are minority groups that have suffered far more than the Mormon pioneers. But there was an extermination order in Missouri, and many that were murdered. And there was a militia where it was legal to kill, and they were on the run. They were trying to find a place where they just wouldn't be bothered, which isn't unlike what Caesar's trying to do here.
Right.
And so, like, it's amazing that even, like, you know, a sub-religious culture can equate, like, a Caesar with a Brigham Young and, like, and the idea of imprisonment. Because they were getting jailed in Missouri left and right? Like, there are just a lot of people in prisons. And so them finally finding their oasis, you know, in Salt Lake, which is, you know, a strong term to describe it, but.
Right. No. What's funny is I had the exact same thought when they came across that, lake in the forest. I was like, oh, okay. I know what David's thinking now.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking about Brother Brigham.
Yeah. And I really thought that once Caesar took on the multiple wives, I was like,
well, that's the crazy. Yeah. The polygamy subplot. I didn't see coming.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily relate to movies that way personally. It wasn't the reason why I enjoyed it per se. I just thought it was a funny analogy that I knew people, you know, my culture would definitely.
Yeah, and it's a similar story that a lot of different minority groups have told.
Anyone in exile that's looking for their place.
Right, and I think that's one of the universal appeals of this story, and I think that's one of the reasons it's going to do well, I think, overseas. Yeah. It doesn't hurt the fact that the Americans are literally the bad guys in this.
Yeah, they are the bad guys. Yeah. There's also this sense of, like, you know, humans will always fight each other. They have right. for the history of time. They will continue to do so. And this, I don't know, there's something, not poetic, but like this, but it, fascinating that this, like, act of just nature completely wiped out two warring groups. One that had good intentions, humans that were fighting the other humans because they had gone crazy. They were, you know, mm-hmm. killing their own because of the virus. And so they're trying to stop him from doing that, and I could get that. But in the end, it didn't really matter. One avalanche later, and it just completely wipes out these two armies.
Right, and that's, I think that plays with the one of the themes is the futility of war. And I yeah. think that's really on display, like you said, in the very final scene when the Earth decides to shake everyone off with an avalanche.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought it was also poetic, the fact that the apes survived the avalanche because they were hanging onto the trees.
Yeah, yeah.
That was great.
I was going to ask, what did you think of Steve Zahn, the ape?
I had a little bit of issue with him
because he's comic relief. Playing,
yeah, he's doing the comic relief, but very, it's fine. Like,
yeah,
he was very, very much the comic relief.
But I've talked to people who, like, my parents went and saw it. They both really liked mm-hmm. it. My little brother saw it, really liked it, and they both cited Steve Zahn's, you know, ape character as something that helped break up the, because it's really dark.
It's a dark film. Yeah.
They, you know, for those people, if. You know, my parents don't love that much darkness for that long, and he was just enough of this comic relief for those, you know, people like my parents to continue to enjoy the film. I was going to mention something else that I read, because the fascinating thing here with clearing the deck of the main actors, the human actors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then just kind of restocking, is that you want to know what happens to the past, like Jason Clarke's character.
Right.
What happens to him? Did you read anything about this?
No, I think that I read something that he was referenced at some point, but I never read yeah. into it. I don't know what the reference was.
The scene is when Caesar is talking to Woody Harrelson's colonel in that, you mm-hmm. know, that whole scene where he explains all about the virus. You know, he's at, kind of in his bunker or whatever.
Yeah.
There was in an early script, Matt Reeves was saying that there was a line where he referenced that character, Jason Clarke's character from Dawn, and I'm forgetting the mm-hmm. character name. Ultimately, he cut it out because... there was so much to explain in that scene, which is true, that it was yeah. just, it didn't really fit the flow or necessary information. It didn't make sense. But he said that the conversation was that Woody Harrelson brings up coming across that human, that mm. guy, you know, and that he believed that they could coexist with the apes. And Caesar was like, oh, you know, like, I, you know, I know him. And he says, what happened to him? And Woody Harrelson said, I killed him because his ideas are dangerous.
Oh, wow.
And so essentially that was the intent in the script, was that Woody Harrelson came across him, and it's who knows how long they were with each other in whatever camp. But the idea of Jason right. Clarke pushing for, you know, the ability to not eradicate them, but to coexist is eventually what killed him.
Right. I actually went back after watching War, and I went back and watched Dawn again.
Oh, you did?
It's so good. It's really, really, it's a really good movie, and it just solidified my stance on it. But I had to be sure that it wasn't my favorite.
So I'm not sure, and I haven't rewatched Dawn yet because I'm not quite ready to say War is my favorite, because yeah. a little bit of me feels like Dawn still has the edge, but I haven't rewatched it recently.
So for me, Dawn is just a little there isn't enough of an arc to the story for okay. me, and it's a little too one note. And I know people are saying the similar thing about War, but I feel like. The culmination of War is just satisfying enough that I, you know, I wanted something like that in Dawn. And in Dawn, you get the killing of, what's the other guy, Koba?
Koba,
You get that killing, but that's about it. So I was looking for something more than that, and I think I got that in War. But when I went back and watched Dawn, I was just like, Gary Oldman, he's great. He's, you know, he gave a great performance in this, but I just felt like I was watching... Gordon, Chief Gordon.
Or Commissioner Gordon.
Commissioner Gordon, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know, there's just something about, like, old Gary Oldman now. He just looks like Commissioner Gordon in everything
yeah,
that he
I know.
Does.
And he can't even, like, I love Gary Oldman. He's been in a lot of really great movies, and yeah. I respect his filmography. I really do. But he's getting in this later, kind of this later age in life where he's not even trying to get the American accent down. Like, there are words that are just like, and I didn't even know. I thought he was just straight up British.
Yeah.
But he, I think he actually might be like Irish or Scottish or something.
Oh, uh-huh.
But like, you know, it comes through in these words, even as Commissioner Gordon, where he's just talking. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's, you're not even trying an American accent.
Yeah, I think that I think you're right. He's in the later stages of his career of caring. He's in like the Al Pacino, the early stages of Al Pacino.
Yes, yes, yes. And I cannot wait to see Al Pacino as Joe Paterno not caring. Because you know who didn't care? Joe Paterno.
He's perfect for it. It's perfect casting. What's the prosthetic? Do they use prosthetics on his nose for Paterno?
No, I just think they just amped up the lenses in his glasses just to make the nose seem bigger. No, I think he's wearing prosthetics. He looks like Joe Paterno in that photo. Oh, actually,
he's nailing it. That's perfect.
And so it makes me like, it makes me wish we were at peak Pacino.
Is that an HBO movie or is that a?
It certainly feels like it's going to be an HBO movie, but I don't think it is. Actually, I think it's a legit.
Well, I think I asked because Pacino's done a number of like direct HBO movies.
Yeah, as has De Niro recently.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm looking it up now because I would be so shocked if this is a widely released film.
Who's going to watch it is my question. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Who wants to watch?
Who's the audience for that?
Like the people that are fans of Joe Paterno, right? Like that legacy, like you could, there was a world where you could have made a movie about his life and what he did before the end of his life happened. Right.
Right.
And now it's like, well, who wants to go see Joe Paterno, the guy that turned a blind eye to molestation? Who wants that?
Exactly. So I work in Pasadena right next to the Rose Bowl, and this past Rose Bowl, Penn State was there. And so driving to work on the way there, there was a giant paper handmade banner that said Joe Pa knew. I saw it the following Monday after it happened, after the Rose Bowl. So it had been up for a while.
And was that before, or when was this?
This was this past Rose Bowl. In January. Was it January? Yeah. December, January.
I'm looking it up now. You are right. It is an HBO film. That makes a lot more sense. Directed by Barry Levinson.
Okay.
I know. I don't know what to do about that.
I guess. I mean, you want to talk about two guys that are in the final stages. I was going to say,
the last time Barry Levinson made a good movie was the last time Al Pacino had a good performance. I don't think they have a release date or a title. It's an as yet untitled. So
anyway. I hope it's just called Joe Pa New.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's just called Joe Pa New.
Oh my gosh. Or just Joe and Jerry.
Shower time with Jerry.
Oh gosh. Oh, that guy's still from his prison, or he died, right? No, he's still in prison.
No, he's alive. He's in jail.
Oh, yeah. That was Aaron Hernandez. Okay. Yeah. No, but like that still in the guy has, I guess that's all you can do at this point is just continue to maintain your innocence, even though it's just absolutely positively you're guilty, right?
Yeah. Well, I've actually started I don't know if you saw this, but I started a change.org petition.
Oh, did you?
It's a free Jerry Sandusky petition.
Oh, why?
Yeah. So there's only two signatures on there right now. One is me, and then the second one is Jared Fogle.
Oh, my gosh. Is your basis kind of like, since Jerry says he didn't do it, then he probably didn't do it?
Oh, yeah. He's been framed. Yeah. I think been framed.
Look, it's just like Putin said that he didn't, you know, meddle in the election.
Mm-hmm.
We got to take him at his word, just like Jerry.
Well, yeah. Oliver Stone also said that he believes him.
What are we going to do about this, Aaron? So Zach Lowe and Bill Simmons talk about being on Dion Waiters Island, right? Like the last two guys who believe in Dion Waiters. You and I are on Oliver Stone Island, okay? You and I have the prime real estate right now on Oliver Stone Island. And he is not doing us any favors with these Putin documentaries. Not good at all.
No, I can't. I want to be forgiving of Oliver Stone because I love the man's work.
And he's given us so much good stuff.
He really has. He had a good 20-year run of 5-6 movies that are excellent.
Yep.
The Putin stuff.
Well, it's so weird and bizarre, and I get that he ruffles feathers and he like doesn't like to be put in a box for someone who's very, very liberal and progressive.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, he's first and foremost, he's anti-American establishment.
Yeah. Right.
So, and the American establishment is very anti-Putin.
Right.
So that's so why he's jumping on bandwagon. But because he did similar stuff with Hugo Chavez too. So.
That's right. No. Right. From what I've read and gathered, his son actually works for a Russian news network.
RT.
Yeah. And so I think that has something to do with like why he's probably more like willing to, you know, believe Putin and I'm sure that's how he also probably got access. You know.
Right.
In addition to making the wonderful JFK movie.
Right. So who was it in the Trump campaign that was at the RT dinner? Oh, man, there's a photo with him sitting next
to
Putin.
Was it Manafort?
No, I don't think it was Manafort. I think it was...
Flynn? It was Flynn.
It was Flynn.
Yeah,
it was,
that's right.
It was Michael Flynn. And also at that table was the nominee for the Green Party in the election.
Stein.
Jill Stein.
Jill Stein?
She works for RT. Yeah, she worked for RT.
Oh, no. Oh, my gosh. My apologies to the Jill Stein supporters out there listening.
Well, you voted for her.
I did, yeah. I voted for her in the primary.
Right.
And then again
in
the general.
Well, you voted for her, after you saw the photo. That's what I'm saying,
I wasn't going to vote for her in the general. Then I saw the photo, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm in.
You said, I'm a Steinhead. Let's do this.
Let's do this. I'm in. Buckle up. You know, can I tell you a funny story?
Let's hear it.
Someone at church yesterday called me a Democrat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Lovingly, but definitely derisively. He's like, oh, you little Democrat. I don't know why I'm telling the story on the pod, actually. This is probably an off-the-pod story.
No, this is good. He wanted to call you a liberal, by the way. He didn't want to just call you a Democrat. He softened it up for you and called you a Democrat.
He did soften it up for me, right? There's a prominent Mormon leader that was like in the what's called the First Presidency, which is like one of the leading governing body, who was a prominent Democrat. He's since passed away, but my response was to him was, yeah, just like so and so, like the Mormon leaders, you know. did not take my response well, but gosh, sometimes it feels good to be a liberal Mormon. And I'm not even that liberal, by the way.
Sometimes that's all you got is your personal beliefs and the fact that you're on the right side of history.
Oh gosh!
But I will say that I don't ride with with Oliver Stone on this Putin stuff.
Back to the Putin stuff. No, of course we don't ride with him here. Look, I guess he's allowed a mulligan. That's a pretty big mulligan. I guess Alexander was also a mulligan.
As was Wall Street too.
Oh, money never sleeps. Dude, Shia. Poor Shia.
Oh, boy.
Guy can't catch a break.
Especially from a black cop.
Oh, gosh. Oh. Well, I know we're about out of time, and we're just about at 40 minutes.
But yeah, go see Apes.
Man. Go see War for the Planet of the Apes, please. Everyone, go see this film. It's absolutely worth it. It's a technical marvel. It's a great story. You rarely get a combination of those two things, where Valerian will likely be a technical marvel, but nothing else.
Right.
This actually has all the goods. And hopefully we can bring on my friend that works at Weta and see if he can give us, you know, any insight. That way I can finally one-up Skylar's interview of David Lowery, which we haven't mentioned. If you haven't listened, Skylar secured a legit press junket interview over the phone with David Lauer, who's pubbing A Ghost Story starring Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. He directed Pete's Dragon. He did Ain't Them Body Saints. If you haven't listened, please listen. And if you thought it was a fake, you know, interview, no, it's very real. It's very much him. In fact, Skylar does this thing where he reads reviews from on Rotten Tomatoes for A Ghost Story and for the film Ghost, Patrick Swayze. And he has him guess which review was for which film. So it's a blast. Listen to it. Also, we just dropped a Patreon episode for The Big Sick, Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon's film.
Very good movie.
And so if you're not a Patreon subscriber, please check it out. Patreon.com/Brave Little Podcast. Just $3 a month and you get great content. That was a great episode. I was cussed out by Skylar. It was a painstaking editing job to get all the bleeps in, so I kept it PG-13. There's a lot of fireworks. Some of us loved the movie, some of us hated it. So please take a listen and subscribe on our Patreon. All right. Anything else, Aaron? Our next film is, right?
Our next film is Dunkirk.
Dunkirk.
Dun, dun, dun.
You got your tickets to see it. I got I'm seeing it 70mm IMAX in downtown SAC.
That's a true baller right there. I'm just regular 70mm. Oh, no, well, IMAX.
You'll have to tell me what that experience is like. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Go see Apes. As we say,
hold on to your butts. Thank you for listening to the Brave Little Podcast. Hold on to your butts.